The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, friends. This is Larry Wilson for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Money Matters. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Money.com and also from KiplingerPersonalFinance.com. Our first article from Money.com, when the Fed will cut interest rates. Here are the latest predictions. The latest inflation data was a setback for hopes of an interest rate cut at the Federal Reserve's June meeting. Analysts at major banks changed their forecasts for the timing of interest rate cuts after the March Consumer Price Index, or CPI, report, which showed inflation accelerated to an annual rate of 3.5%. The hot CPI reading was driven by cost increases in March for things including car insurance and medical care. Meanwhile, increases in shelter prices accounted for more than 60% of overall annual inflation. The Fed uses interest rate hikes as a means of slowing the economy to battle inflation, and it is likely to lower rates only when inflation is in check. Previously, many on Wall Street were expecting 3/4-point interest rate cuts in 2024, and that aligned with the most recent projections from Fed officials released on March 20th. Now, optimism is waning in terms of how soon Fed will cut interest rates and when they will be cut, as well as how many cuts there will be this year. Interest rates have far-reaching effects on the economy. Americans are still dealing with some of the highest loan rates in years. According to the National Association of Realtors, mortgage rates will likely rise above 7% following this inflation date update. There have also been positive aspects of this current rate environment, like better returns on certificates of deposits. Before rates can be cut, Fed officials are waiting for evidence that inflation is closer to the 2% target level. The main question right now is how long it will take for them to get there. This week, economists at companies including Goldman Sachs, UBS, and Bank of America revised their predictions after the CPI print. They no longer expect 3 rate cuts in 2024, and say the first cut likely won't come until at least July. Will the Federal Reserve cut rates in June? A June rate cut looks much less likely than it did a few days ago. However, the Fed could still decide to go forward with a rate cut in June if officials feel that interest rates are too restrictive. Any data showing that inflation is slowing down or that the labor market is cooling would help the argument for a June rate cut. We believe 3% rate cuts are plausible for 2024. Market pricing is beginning to reflect risk of even 2 cuts this year, but right now 3 is our base case. Gauri Shahura, head of BlackRock's iShares Investment Strategy in the America, said in a Wednesday note. However, she adds that it is looking more likely that these forecasted cuts will start sometime after June. Analysts still expecting cuts later in the year. The new market expectation is for there to be 2 rate cuts in 2024, with the first one happening by September, according to the CME FedWatch tool. Rohan Reddy, director of research at Global X, a thematic ETF firm, says the latest CPI data reignited concerns about inflation, likely pushing back the timeline for cuts. This is now the third straight month that CPI has beat expectations, so this will give the Fed additional reason to delay rate cuts further, Reddy says. Economists at Bank of America, who updated their forecast Thursday to only call for one rate this year in December, said the inflation data will make Fed officials worried about the risk of cutting too soon. "We think the Fed will have difficulty reaching a consensus to cut rates in June. It was a close call to begin with the committee roughly 50-50 between expecting three or more cuts this year versus fewer than three at the time of the March meeting. Hence, we take a June rate cut off the table," analysts said in a note. "We think this rationale also rules out cuts that start in July or September. We just don't see enough progress on inflation and its components by then." Goldman Sachs is forecasting two rate cuts in 2024 starting in July, while UBS expects the same number but starting in September. Is another interest rate hike possible? In recent weeks, most of the discussion around the Fed has been about when it will cut rates, but the latest inflation reading was a reminder that cuts aren't guaranteed this year, and it's always possible that there could be another rate hike if economic conditions change. With unemployment strong and commodity prices heating up, the Fed's next move could very well be a rate hike to tame prices and keep inflation under control, Skyler Wynyard, chief investment officer at Regan Capital, said in a note. Joe Davis, chief global economist at Vanguard, echoed the concern that there's too much focus on cutting. "I have been confused as why the rush to cut," he said in a note. "There are still embers of inflation here and there in the economy." And from Money.com, why the right retirement age doesn't actually exist. In the midst of the Great Depression, the passage of the Social Security Act established a national retirement age of 65 as the standard, guaranteeing that older workers could retire and receive crucial benefits for the first time in U.S. history. The average life expectancy in 1935, however, was just 58 for men and 62 for women. Only a little more than half of the nation's men were expected to live to see 65, according to a document from the Social Security Administration's archives. The age of 65 was chosen not because it was the optimal time for people to stop working, but because, as labor economist Teresa Ghilarducci puts it, it was cheap. There was a lot of opposition to a national retirement plan. Setting the age at 65, when life expectancy was a lot lower than it is today, was a political decision to get the Social Security legislation through, she says. Push to raise the Social Security retirement age. The average life expectancy has grown significantly in the years since the landmark social reform was created, and so has the program. Over 50 million retirees and their dependents receive benefits as of 2023, and they tend to collect them for much longer than the founders of Social Security anticipated, often for decades. Due in large part to this swelling population of older people, the trust fund that pays for Social Security was barreling towards insolvency in 1983. That's when Congress voted to incrementally raise the full retirement age to 67, over 33 years for workers born after 1959. Now, with record numbers of Americans expected to turn 65 over the next few years, Social Security is approaching another funding crisis. If lawmakers do not pass new reforms in the next decade, Economists estimate there will be a universal 23% Social Security benefits cut. One option is to raise the retirement age again, a position touted mostly by the political right. On the campaign trail, former Republican presidential candidate Nikki Haley advocated for changing the retirement age for people currently in their 20s to, quote, match life expectancy. And in a March budget proposal, a group of House Republicans argued that modest adjustments to the retirement age are necessary to account for Americans' increased longevity. The private sector has chimed in recently as well. In an annual letter to shareholders, BlackRock CEO Larry Fink said that no one should have to work longer than they want to, but in the same breath called the idea of sexagenarian retirement a bit crazy. According to this logic, bumping up the retirement age may seem like a no-brainer. If people are living longer, healthier lives, then shouldn't it make sense that they work longer too? Economists and experts in aging largely say no, warning that the move would not only amount to a reduction in benefits at every age, but potentially harm the health of most older Americans. Live longer, work longer. Lately, research and subsequent news articles trumpeting the alleged advantages of delaying retirement seem to be popping up all over the place. In a December study, the Pew Research Center found that the number of working 65-plus-year-old Americans nearly doubled from 1987 to 2023, and that they reported higher levels of job satisfaction compared to younger workers. The headline of a recent Fortune story citing the Pew data proclaims, quote, "The new retirement is no retirement. Baby boomers are keeping jobs well into their 60s and 70s because they like going to work." There's a lot of research that shows that people who are working in old age are healthier than people who are retired in old age, Giller Ducey says. And in surveys of people who have chosen to keep on working, they have usually chosen it because they have a good match to their job. The retirement age adults who do benefit from working tend to be in positions of greater privilege and have higher paid, quote, knowledge-based occupations. This group of workers tend to have more control over the pace and requirements of their jobs, but they're far from the majority. A closer look reveals another, less flattering story about working into old age. While there certainly are older adults who want to work, most who are working past the traditional retirement age have to out of financial need, and the latter don't necessarily benefit from doing so. Giller Ducey says her research shows that for most people, especially those in physically demanding and low-paid positions, working into their golden years typically causes them physical, mental, and emotional harm. This skewed idea that working longer makes older adults healthier is not relevant or true for 90% of the population, Giller Ducey adds. For almost everybody, the secretary, the healthcare worker, the retail clerk, research is finding retirement with enough income is better for their health. There are racial, ethnic, and gender implications when it comes to retirement age, too. Christina Matz, director of Boston College's Center on Aging and Work, says that certain groups, like Hispanic, Black, and women workers, have shortened working life expectancy due to their disproportionate representation in poor quality work. The reality of raising the retirement age. Delaying retirement isn't possible for many older people, even if they have a financial need to continue working. A recent survey from insurance company MassMutual found that nearly half of retirees left the workforce earlier than planned, with a third of that group reporting that they were forced to because of changes at work. A quarter said they had to leave their jobs early because of an illness or injury. Matz says that caretaking responsibilities, such as in the case of a spouse developing dementia, are another major contributor to early retirement. These early retirees often have no choice but to claim benefits before the full retirement age, resulting in lower payments for people who need benefits the most, according to Gilarici. Based on her findings, raising the age for Social Security benefits further exacerbates socioeconomic inequities in retirement, accelerating death and negative health consequences for people who are less well-off financially. Matz is in agreement. The literature is really becoming very clear. Working longer is not an option for a good portion of the workforce, she says. What's the best age to retire? What would the ideal retirement age be if well-being was top policy priority rather than political and monetary interest? Matz argues that retirement policy shouldn't be based on chronological age at all, but a variety of factors that account for the diversity of workers' experiences and abilities. It's really hard to make any kind of a blanket policy with these types of questions, she adds. Gilarducci proposes a Gray New Deal to overhaul the retirement system, which she outlines in her latest book, Work, Retire, Repeat: The Uncertainty of Retirement in the New Economy. Every occupation, she says, would ideally have its own retirement age depending on the physical and mental requirements. What's more, all workers would have guaranteed lifetime retirement income through a universal pension system, much like police officers and many other unionized workers enjoy today, and more Social Security benefits. If older people want to keep working regardless of the reason, Gilarducci adds that health-focused policies would help them stay productive, and no one would feel forced to work late in life. Every adult would have access to jobs that they're suited for, and employment training through public programs. Notably, workers would be protected by built-in anti-age discrimination laws and have more say in when and how they retire. A sign of a good society is that the definition of a working age adult changes, she says. And continuing our readings from Money.com, the best week to list your home for sale is right now. Above average home prices plus faster sales make this week of mid-April the best time of year to list a home. That's according to a report from Realtor.com based on an analysis of housing market data since 2018. The report excluded data from 2020 because the pandemic caused abnormal activity in the housing market. The week of April 14th to April the 20th does not have the highest price or the lowest time on the market of the year, but it represents a balanced selection of market conditions that favor sellers, Realtor.com said in the report. A median list price this week is expected to be $7,400 higher than the average week of 2024, and homes will sell 17% faster than the historical average, according to the forecast. Other metrics that went into the analysis include buyer demand as measured by views per listing on Realtor.com, the chance of price reductions, and the level of competitive and competition among the sellers. Mortgage rates weren't considered because there's little seasonality in rate trends, but the report concedes rates do play a factor in the decision to sell. Some homeowners feel locked in to their current mortgages because selling and then buying elsewhere would involve taking out a new loan with a significantly worse rate. However, Realtor.com notes that inventory is about 40% lower than the pre-pandemic level, meaning that many local markets are fairly competitive and seller-friendly right now. And market conditions peak for sellers in the spring. Realtor.com's findings won't be surprising for those who follow real estate news, given that the spring season is well known as the peak time of year for activity in the housing market. As spring blossoms, homes often have better curb appeal. It's also a natural time for many families to move, with school years ending in May or early June. But there isn't a consensus among real estate experts that April is the best time to sell. A separate report from Zillow earlier this year found that while May had long been the best month to list a home for sale, June was the optimal time in 2023. That's because mortgage rates dipped around that time. While there's a chance that mortgage rates could dip around the same time in 2024, the likelihood has decreased due to high inflation numbers and strong jobs data. Many analysts now expect that the Federal Reserve won't cut interest rates until at least July. And from KiplingerPersonalFinance.com, here's an interesting article, Being Rich versus Being Wealthy. What's the difference? It's all about where you put the zeros. Having a large bank account isn't the same as having zero regrets and focusing on what brings you joy. This article is written by Andrew Rosen, who's a financial advisor. As a financial advisor, one of the topics that I often talk about is being rich versus being wealthy. While those terms may seem like they're the same concept, there are nuances between them, and you can be rich without being wealthy, and vice versa. What I've also found is that the difference between being rich and being wealthy comes down to where you have the most zeros. For most people, when they think of the word rich, they're likely thinking of assets, money, real estate, etc. And while there's nothing wrong with growing your assets, I've even made a career out of helping people do just that, at the end of the day, no one cares about how much you're worth and how much money you make. Harvard has conducted a long-running study since 1938 that followed 724 teenagers from their youth to their retirement. The happiest among those were retired who had similar traits when it came to their mindset, not their bank account. This study suggested that there was an association between connections, such as your social circle and happiness when you reach retirement age, and you don't find that in the zeros of your bank account. The thing that those in the study missed the most about their working years wasn't the work or making money either. It was the connections with those around them. In retirement, discussion turns to pleasures rather than worth. I recently visited my mother at her retirement community in Florida, and not once did anyone talk about their career, their worth, or what they did for a living. While they all had to have some level of, quote, rich to be living in this particular retirement community, this wasn't a topic of discussion. They spent their time talking about their hobbies, their grandkids, and what they enjoyed doing with their lives. That's the difference between being rich and being wealthy. Being rich means adding more zeros to your bank account. Being wealthy is about living your life with zero regrets, zero jealousy, and focusing on what brings you joy and happiness. In my experience, the happiest people I know are the wealthiest, and it has nothing to do with how much is in their bank accounts. One of my favorite phrases is, quote, money is a catalyst, because once you hit a certain income level where you're living comfortably, money is just money. If you're a happy person living with an income of $100,000 per year, an income of $500,000 isn't going to change your happiness level drastically. The opposite is true here, too. If you are miserable earning $100,000 per year, $500,000 isn't going to suddenly make you a happy person. Obviously, this is only true when you're living at a level where you're earning enough that your needs are being met. Money alone won't make you happy. Some of the wealthiest people I know with the largest bank balances are also the most miserable. Money alone won't make you happy, and it's likely that if you're a happy person earning a modest amount, you'd still be a happy person if you're rich. The same goes for someone who's miserable. They'll be miserable if they were middle income or rich. When it comes down to it, happiness isn't reliant upon how many zeros are in your bank account. It takes effort to reframe your thoughts, find what truly makes you happy, and refocus and prioritize your decision making around that. Prioritizing what makes you happy may lead you into retirement being truly wealthy, where you can focus on the social connections that the Harvard study found so important to happiness. And those are good words of wisdom for all of us. And as we wrap up our episode today, there's a few interesting facts about gold. When people worry about the economy, their thoughts often turn to gold. Here are some nuggets of truth. 92.5% of the Olympic gold medals are at least 92.5% silver. And is gold a good defense against inflation? Sometimes yes. As inflation soared from 1976 to 1980, gold's purchasing power nearly tripled. However, more recently, the answer to that is no. As inflation took off between May of 2020 and June of 2022, gold's purchasing power fell 9%. And we are out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. Thank you for joining us. And until next time, this is Larry Wilson. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving our community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Money Matters is also available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.